You're listening First Time Dads!
With me, Richard Innes.
And me, Steve Meyer.
Hello, hello, hello. For this fine episode, we were joined by Matt Farquharson, who is better known as Papa Pucker, the other half of the Mother Pucker podcast.
We got up with Matt to talk about a new book that he's been working on with his wife, Anna, about how actually having kids can really damage your relationship. We also spoke to him about the battle for parents who are flexible working and the various challenges society places in their ways. It's fascinating. Listen. Matt. Thanks for coming in, first time dads.
That's all right. Thanks for asking me along.
Matt, you are obviously a podcaster, like us.
Yes.
And a dad. What have you got?
Two girls. One's two and one's six. So I've kind of forgotten everything about the little ones and sort of the horror of the sleepless nights at the beginning.
Yeah.
And also that two is kind of this weird crossover of peak adorability where they say very cute things and maximum frustration where they can't do anything, but they're determined to do it.
Yes.
And every time you walk out the house, it's like trying to take a hedgehog for a walk or something.
Yes. That is so nice to hear, because my 2.5-year-old at the moment, I was having this conversation with someone just the other day, in fact yesterday, that he is either the most wonderful, lovely, heart-meltingly wonderful, lovely, brilliant little human being in the world, or he's the devil. And there is no in between.
Yeah.
And the thing I keep coming back to, and I suppose this is again part of the reason we do this podcast in the first place, is everyone else thinking this about their 2-year-old? So it's quite reassuring. It's always reassuring to know, okay, we're not the only ones.
I think that's a very common trait that you flip from the sort of spontaneous shin cuddle and just outpouring of adoration from this tiny creature face plant on the floor, screaming and kicking their feet up and down like some kind of like cat in a tumble dryer or something.
So Iris is 15 months and she's just mastered what I describe as the extinction rebellion muscle relax.
Which means
you can't get to do
they
anything.
They go full on Vietnam war protesters.
Exactly.
The floppiness. How do they know to do that?
I don't know. I think it's just instinctive.
It's just kind of, I know what will mean he can't pick me up. I'll just go really floppy. And then, I quite often
go for the sort of rugby ball under the arm technique. Okay. Just scoop up, hold the little one like she's a rugby ball and just sort of march along. And you get these kind of, these really sympathetic looks from people, I think. I was worried that if people saw me doing that, they'd think I was a terrible dad and basically being really mean. But I think anyone who has ever seen a 2-year-old before looks at you with this sort of knowing understanding, which is quite reassuring.
That's the thing, and I think that's what we need to do more of. I've said on this podcast before that I think all we really want to hear from other dads is how awful their children are.
Yes.
No one wants to know that your child's being lovely. Yes. No, not interested. Not interested in the slightest. What I want to know is your child being dreadful? If your child's been dreadful, please talk to me, because then I can tell you when my child's dreadful, and that's what we all want, right?
My approach is if either of them start, well, she doesn't really play up because she's only 15 months, but when he does, it's like a snatch squad. Just grab him, get him out of that environment as quickly as possible. Yeah. Don't get into some sort of debate in a supermarket aisle where, and then more attention gathers and then people like start looking surrounding you.
Yeah.
Just want to get him out of there. And
it's all about distraction, I think. And I sometimes, with our 6-year-old, I sometimes forget that, because actually, you know, she can form coherent sentences and she can have a discussion about things. And I try and reason with her and explain what, you know, we should be doing, but it always backfires because she just says, yeah, but I just want a snack. Why can't I have a snack? Where's the chocolate? Why won't you bring me the chocolate? And she won't accept any of the arguments against that. But what my wife Anna is very good at is the distraction thing of oh, look, there's a squirrel or what have you. Even if there isn't really a squirrel there.
I wonder if we're guilty of this as dads more than mothers, potentially. But we've spoken to experts recently, actually, experts in inverted commas, who have explained that, okay, there's no point having these discussions. And like to your point, distraction is just the way forward.
Yeah.
There's no point getting into this back and forth. And I was sort of labouring under the illusion that I was being a good parent. by sitting down and talking to my child and trying to have a back and forth. And let's talk about your emotions and let's try and figure out why you did that. And of course, various people have said to us recently, well, that's nonsense. He's two. You can't do that.
Yes.
And I do wonder if dads are more kind of prone to that sort of thing. I know what I'll do. I'll have a conversation.
This is exactly the mistake that I make. And it never works, because you kind of think that, you know, it's all about eye contact and calmness and discussion.
Look at me. Look at
and
me.
And I'm
We're
filling
talking.
Them
Look
full of life skills about debating and getting their point across and what have you. But quite often my six-year-old will just turn around to me and say, stop talking to me, you're making me angry.
Okay. Well, that's good. She's getting a point across.
Does and that, quite often at quite a high decibel okay. as well.
Do you hear Anna's voice when you hear that?
No, well, ironically, I think with us it's the other way around. Okay. She's always the one that wants to talk about an issue, whereas I'm quite happy to go and sulk and
I think that's
let it pass.
Man, isn't it?
It is, you know, it is amazing how easily we slip into those stereotypes without...
It's that men are from Mars, women are from Venus, isn't it? It's like the man wants to go into the cave, and the woman follows him in to try and solve the problem. She says, leave me in my cave.
It's terrible. And I kind of try, particularly because I've got two daughters, I'm very aware of sort of societal, cultural impact on girls in particular. Mm. And you know, very keen to say, look, you can play with the dinosaurs or the trucks as well as the pink dolly. It's up to you and so on. But I just find myself reverting to these really old-fashioned, stereotypical man ways in that I have spent quite a lot of time looking online at great sheds where I could potentially spend a bit of time, and this could be my new working space.
Yes, I like it.
But basically all I want is a chair in a dark room where no one can get to me.
We're destined to become our own fathers. I increasingly believe that, because it is. I'm exactly the same. I had a conversation with someone recently. So what type of dad are you? You know, I said, well, I wanted to be, you know, the kind of modern, progressive, liberal, very kind of forward-thinking father who would do this and do that. And actually, and it's no bad thing, because my dad was a very good dad and brought myself and my siblings up very well. But increasingly, it's almost just like a reflex. And I hear my dad in the way I'm talking to my boys, because it's just, I suppose it's almost inevitable.
Well,
I
want a six-pack, but I'm not going to get one. So it's the same sort of thing. Things are going to happen. I think to change how you are as a dad, it's going to take generations and generations and generations to go forward. But it sort of brings us on to our sort of discussion about we're going to have about social media, perhaps.
Yeah.
And this space that is filled by perfect parents on social media, on Instagram, and the kind of filtered stuff and all that. And the podcast that you guys do and the podcast that we do, I hope, is a bit more honest about what it's like to be a parent.
Yes. I mean, I think ours is probably occasionally far too honest.
You've certainly got more explicit content.
It does get quite biological quite quickly. I
do bite my tongue a little bit on the old swearing front on here deliberately, so it's good to know that you cut loose.
Yeah, well, we do. I mean, that was, to be honest, part of the idea behind Mother Pucker in the first place. It was something that my wife started. And basically, we just moved back to London, and Instagram was a relatively new thing, and someone said, you know, it's actually quite a nice way to meet other mums. It's kind of like someone described it to her as like Tinder for stressed out mums who want to find mates. And she started looking at it. And when she was sort of breastfeeding with our first one in the wee hours of the morning, she was scrolling through these feeds, and she was getting all of the posts from the States because of the time of night it was. And there were all these amazing looking women in tiny bikinis with these gorgeous looking kids. And I think that's particularly common over that side.
Yeah.
Mm.
And she found it a little bit off-putting, actually, and actually quite almost a little bit depressing, I think, and decided that actually she would want to do something that was a bit more honest and open about the parenting experience and the stresses and the horror of it. Mm-hmm. And that's how Mother Pucker came about, partly. And what we discovered was that by being quite honest about the horrors of it, and, you know, some serious issues like sort of like miscarriage and so on and things like that, she got so many messages from people saying, actually, this has made me feel much better. I was feeling really down about, you know, everyone else seems to be doing it better than me. It's, you know, it's quite a relief to know that you're hopeless too.
Mm.
And I think there's something healthy about that. And if you look for them, there are quite a lot of accounts like that. You know, there's a billion Instagram accounts. You can find one that fits you and makes you and keeps you interested in something and doesn't make you feel bad. Yeah.
But it goes back to our point, doesn't it, that we were discussing beforehand about that idea of wanting solidarity with other people who are struggling. You don't want to feel that pressure of, oh great, so you're doing brilliantly and I'm doing awfully. And there is so much of social media in relation to parenting which I think does that and has a really negative impact on people, particularly mums, actually, in fairness.
And am I right in thinking, I have a recollection of hearing Anna speak, or she was talking about, she used to work in magazines, and there was a point at which they go, well, we'll take the woman up to a certain point in her life until you get married, and then
she works for Glossy Women's Mag, weeklies and monthlies, and it was fairly common to hear it said in the office, we don't go beyond the maternity ward. And that's it. And it stops. And actually, if you think about it, in the magazine market in the UK, there's things like Grazia and Stylist and so on, for probably aimed at younger career women. And then there's things like Woman's Own for older women. But actually, there's this big gap in the middle where there are lots of women who mostly still work, probably have kids or are thinking about having kids, have all of these things and these very rich lives, but don't see their lives reflected. Yeah. And I think that's where quite a lot of social media stuff can come in.
I used to write a column actually for one of those magazines you just mentioned in my single days, as a kind of single man talking about being a single man about town type thing. And they would tweak, not details of my stories or what I was writing, but details about me to fit that kind of demographic that they were after. I.e., like, I needed to be a little bit older or a little bit younger.
Yes.
But there's obviously a real awareness within those mags, like you said, about the kind of, this is the woman we're aiming. And anyone beyond that in terms of life progression.
Yes. No, this is the kind of woman we're aiming at, and this is the kind of man that she would probably like.
Mm. Yeah, precisely. Yeah.
And what's been the reaction amongst your social circle, you know, your mates, about talking about being a dad?
Well, I mean, mostly they take the mickey, to be honest.
Sounds familiar.
And think it's kind of ridiculous, which is quite healthy, I think.
Any of my mates have ever listened to this podcast? I think one lad in the office did and said, it's just you lot whinging.
Well, that's the parenting experience. So I've got a mate who is early 40s, resolutely single, has been for 20 years. As a very eager user of Tinder and all the rest of it, has no intention of settling down. And one of the things, and I've asked him about this, you know, do you ever wonder if you'll sort of have kids and so on? He said, well, to be honest, everyone I speak to who has kids makes it sound so appalling that I just can't imagine why I would want to do that.
I'm sure we all have in our slightly darker moments as well those thoughts of like, I wonder what life would have been like right now if I hadn't had these children.
So that is a surprisingly common thing. So I mentioned it just before. We just finished our second book, which is called Where's My Happy Ending, which is about the idea of relationships and where they go in later life and so on. And we looked into quite a lot of the academic research around that. And there's a chapter that looks at kids. And there was some research done in Germany that found that one in five parents, I think it was about 19% of dads, about 18% of mums, secretly wished that they'd never had kids. Like, if there could be a parallel universe where their children had never existed, they would love to step into it. And they all said, you know, and that makes me feel terrible because I adore my children. I don't want anything to happen to them.
You can have both those emotions and feelings simultaneously.
Yeah,
which is
but if there was like a sort of Ebenezer Scrooge, this is your alternative future moment, about one in five people have said that
sliding
actually,
doors.
Yes, exactly. Actually, I would secretly like to step
into it. Yeah, but you see, I would qualify my answer and I would say I'd like to step in there for a week. I'd have a week, just like that, and then be able to step back.
That's a stag do, isn't it?
Yeah, stag do without kind of the amount of alcohol that might kill a small person.
But also, I would worry about that week and how much harm it would do to me long term.
That's what I mean, stag do, isn't it?
Like, I mean, there are lots of stats about the fact that divorced men die sooner and things like that. And actually, you know, if you're sort of middle age and you suddenly find yourself single or divorced or what have you, your diet goes out the window because you're just cooking for yourself. You try and act like you did when you were 25, but obviously it takes its toll much more. I'd be slightly intimidated by what that alternative life would be.
Yeah. Oh, and anecdotally, it appears to me that people who are widowed, it's the men that find new partners quicker, or divorced men that find partners new quicker.
Yes.
And there's a lot of, you know, my mum's generation women who are just like, right, that's it, I'm, you know, quite happy living my life, my independence and stuff, whereas the dads are the ones that go off and start new relationships.
A single life is generally better for women. So married women die younger than single women.
Well, there's research today. And what, is multiple marriages.
Is it the reverse with men?
So if a couple get divorced, typically what will happen is the man will die sooner than if he'd stayed married, and the woman will...
Live longer.
that says everything.
So that is the most telling stat I've ever heard.
They did some research in the States in, I can't remember where it was, in the Midwest somewhere, but they looked at 5,000 couples and they mapped out their health, the ones that stayed together, the ones that didn't. And basically what they found was, in a marriage, the men drink less because they're not hanging around with their flabby-faced beer buddies all the time.
Okay.
Whereas the women drink more because they take on a bit more of their partner's drinking habits. So, you know, if you're a single man who would normally have 30 pints a week and actually you just have a glass of wine every night, then that's quite a big cut back. But actually, if you're a single woman who wouldn't drink that much, you drink a bit more wine.
That sounds very familiar.
And, you know, there's so many times I've sort of said to Anna, do you want a glass of something? Because it's Monday and I've made it to the end. And she said, no, I'm fine. And then she hears the cork pop and goes, oh, all right, go on then.
I literally had that conversation last night because I was watching the football. So it was like, oh, the football's on. I'll just have a quick drink. You know, it's football, right? I've got to have a drink with the football. So I'm just having a quick drink. And Lindsay literally was like, oh, go on then, another one. Because she would never have had that otherwise.
No.
So basically the conclusion of that research is that marriage is good for men and bad for women.
Health-wise.
Although you could probably broaden that out in various...
But there's so much, but it's also, so this wasn't just for straight couples. So there was a big piece of research done in Denmark as well, which found that that single gay men died younger than married gay men, or like civil partnership.
Yep.
Because there is something about that union and having one partner that means that actually men calm down a little bit and start to behave like slightly more reasonable creatures.
But do we know, does having kids shorten your life?
I don't know if it shortens your life. I know that it is universally acknowledged to have a bad impact on your relationship.
Okay.
So there was another piece of research from the University of Texas where they looked at, because there's dozens and dozens of papers about the impact of kids on relationships. And these University of Texas researchers looked at all of these from around the world. And they found that from research in Asia, in Europe, in the Americas, among gay couples and straight couples, among different ethnic groups, their conclusion was something along the lines of that it is universally a bad and has a negative impact on relationship when you have children.
Okay.
I suppose, I mean, to an extent that there is an element of common sense there that says, I don't necessarily find that surprising, which is, I suppose, depressing in itself.
Yes.
Because it's just the nature of it. You know, we've all been there, all in the middle of it.
Well, it's a level
the added of stress.
It's a level of stress, isn't it? And it's a level of it's an extra set of points of difference.
Yes, extra set of points of difference about how you raise kids, but also just the constant demands. I mean, I think because we've all got fairly young kids that can't really tend to themselves yet. They don't really self-facilitate yet. And I think when they're a bit older, there will be different problems, I guess. But just the constant demands that mean actually you don't really have that much time looking eye to eye with your partner and talking about nice stuff. It's basically you get up, you've got kids to deal with and get away somewhere. You go to work, you've got kids to pick up and get to bed, and then it's 8 o'clock.
And
you've probably
and
got some kind of life admin stuff to do after that.
Or you want to just watch Netflix
or
silence.
You just want to absolutely stare at a screen and eat chocolate and drink wine.
Exactly. Just leave me alone.
And just decompress.
Yeah, I have to do that. Yeah. And I don't know if you guys do this, but I do fast forward occasionally in my mind. To, you know, so I'm approaching 40, so I sometimes fast forward to my sort of early to mid 50s and thinking, well, that'll be the time when we can first go on holiday by ourselves, for instance. We can leave the boys with grandparents, or maybe even they'll be old enough to, you know, stay at home on their own. And
that'll be the point where you're that couple that people see on holiday where you're sat in silence, opposition, you've got absolutely nothing to talk about.
We haven't talked about anything other than our children for the last 15 years.
But so that's also really common. So the only group in the UK, I think, where divorce rates are rising is 50 and 60-year-olds. Because people feel less pressure to get married in the first place now. Yep. So actually they only get married if they're really into each other, not just so that their mum stops nagging them or whatever. And actually it's quite common now. They're called silver splitters. Basically they get to the stage where the kids are finally out the door and they turn around and this person that they fell in love with when they were 29 is now 57 and isn't into the same music, and you know, they've kind of they've kind of just been ploughing on relentlessly and not really turning around to look at each other. And that's the one group, and it's not a massive spike, but there's one group where there's a slight uptick in divorce rates.
Just to put a slightly more positive spin on all this, what I would say, just in case there's anyone kind of listening to this thinking, well, I'm going to get divorced, so you know, whatever. The way I tend to look at things, and I'm aware I'm very fortunate with my wife for a number of reasons, but I do occasionally find myself thinking, well, what if I'd stayed with her? You know, I've been in sort of had a few serious relationships before I met my wife. And I do occasionally have that thing with, well, imagine if I was in this situation with young kids, with her, my ex, or one of my exes. And you think, wow, like, I am actually very, very fortunate, because I know that my wife is a very kind of tolerant and patient person. I think, as I do occasionally think, well, that, God, if that, I was lucky.
She
settled. Yeah. But but I do occasionally find myself imagining that. So I think there's a sort of positive spin to it in that sometimes the stress that you're under, if you frame it and contextualize it that way, you think, well, actually, thank God I'm with her and not someone else, because actually, if it was someone else, it would be 100 times worse.
Yes. And I think you're right. It's absolutely important to remember that. And we both sort of stop and remind ourselves of that from time to time. And I also think, actually, yeah, previous partners, I mean, this would have been horrible. We would have been divorced years ago. So you've got to take solace from that and think, actually, despite all of these pressures that are on us, we're relatively civil to each other most of the time and do laugh from time to time and still occasionally do nice things for each other.
Yeah, yeah. I think there is definitely an element that the child acts as a slight extra bit of glue. Yeah. In the relationship.
Yes.
In a way that if you perhaps didn't have a child and you went through a rocky patch, it would be very easy to go, right, I'm going out and I'm going to go and stay at a mate's house and not, you know, whereas if you've got small children, you're not going to do that.
No.
Unless you're, well, I mean, people obviously do that, but certainly most people probably.
Even on a kind of low level argument, I've had that thing where it snaps you back into. I was telling you before that my wife is the very calm one. I'm the lunatic who loses his temper, and occasionally we'll be having a row about something, and voices are starting to get raised. And Ben, my eldest, will shout, "Daddy, stop it!" And you think, "Oh, he's hearing me shout." Yeah, and he's, "Oh, sorry, son. Yeah, no, you're right. Absolutely, sorry." And it just snaps you back into reality, and you realise that you can't actually have that argument because you don't want your kids to hear you arguing.
And it's kind of the same. I'm the grumpy one. I'm the one that snaps and huffs unnecessarily, and Anna is kind of remarkably patient in most things. And you know, when I'm sort of huffing and tutting about the state of the kitchen or whatever, or or one of the kids being a bit difficult, she's the one that's kind of in the nice mood. But so there was with our eldest, 6 months or so ago, Anna and I were having a ridiculous argument about a shelf, which is one of the most mundane domestic things you can possibly imagine. So we bought this shelf, and there was a conversation about whether it should go in the bathroom, which she wanted to do, and have like products on it and maybe a little plant. Or whether it should go in the living room and have books on it, which was my preference. And it was utterly ridiculous. And we were having this, and obviously there was probably some other background thing, but we're having this escalating argument. I was saying, "You're being ridiculous. We've got loads of books that are on the floor. Of course we need a shelf here. You just need fewer products in the bathroom. What's going on?" And this was kind of escalating completely disproportionately. And our then 5-year-old turned around and she just said, "Guys, it's just a shelf."
Yeah, out of the mouths of babes, right? That's
Actually, we both started laughing and thought, actually, I mean, that is quite insightful.
Reassuring.
One of the biggest rows Zoe and I have ever had is when she was very heavily pregnant. We were racing to get our house finished, and we were on for like a baby moon in Lanzarote, and we had to make a decision on some light switches. And I had like my bad mobile phone reception, trying to get up these different light switches on them. This screaming row at each other. About whether to get brushed metal light switches. and in the end, my wife stormed off down the coast, and I thought, I don't know if she's going to come back. You know, she's heavily pregnant, what if she goes into labour? I'm sort of in semi-tears in the villa. And then we ended up just getting the very cheapest plastic light switches you could possibly get.
Imagine if that got to a divorce court. What caused this problem? Well, brushed metal, Your Honour.
But we know but people have got divorced over Football Manager.
That's
they?
True, yeah, that is true. Yeah.
You know,
what, the guy playing it too much?
Yeah.
Football Manager has been listed in several divorce cases, and the guys who make it have that as a bit of a badge of honour.
So, so Facebook apparently crops up in about a third of divorce cases.
Yeah. Really? Wow.
Because either people get caught out in affairs or so on.
Oh, I see, yeah. So that's not really Facebook being
no,
the
I mean, it's no.
I take your point,
It's the cheating, actually.
Yeah.
Sleeping with someone else.
Or they get spotted in a place where they weren't supposed to be, that sort of thing.
Tagged.
Mm. Tagged, yeah.
Tagged in the wrong place.
Yeah.
We've done that to people when they've not been with us. Tagged them.
Have you?
On a night out when they're supposed to still at work.
Well, just to get them in trouble.
Yeah, just to get them in trouble.
Excellent.
That is so out of order.
Do you? I think we might have tagged mates in like Stringfellows or Spearmint Rhinos when they've not been with us. And we've not been in there either. But
yeah, just to clarify.
Just to clarify.
Yeah.
The stuff you've been looking at with relationships and having children and that kind of stuff, we're talking as sort of fairly modern dads. Mm. And I suspect that dads are spending, well, we find that they're spending more time with their kids than ever before. And you and Anna have got this campaign, this flex working campaign. Do you want to tell us a bit about that and how that kind of idea that dads and mums can spend more time with kids through less work or more flexible working?
So it's called Flex Appeal. So it's just hashtag Flex Appeal. And it's basically, this was something that came right at the beginning with Mother Pucker. Basically, we got to the stage where we were living in a flat in London. We had our eldest then was about 18 months or two. We were both doing editorial type roles, and it kind of got to the stage where, and Anna had basically been earning the same amount for the last 10 years on women's magazines, and it got to the stage where she felt it was time to take a corporate job, a brand job. So she got a job for a big beauty brand. But between accepting the job and starting it, they moved their office. So they were in London Bridge, which was about sort of half an hour, 40 minutes, and they moved to East Croydon, which basically would have been about an hour and 15 minutes each way. And basically would have meant that she'd see our nipper asleep and at weekends, effectively. So she asked them for a little bit of flexibility and said, look, if I can start and finish 15 minutes earlier, then I can make the nursery pick up at 6. And they said no. They said, no, we just like everyone to be here at 9 to
15
6.
Minutes? That's what she was asking
she
for?
She was asking for 15 minutes flexibility.
1 hour, 15 minutes. Right,
she was
okay.
For 15 minutes flexibility. Yeah. And it's quite a big, well-known beauty brand and quite an aspirational place to work and so on. And I think like a lot of big organisations, and it's also quite true in media as well, I think there's an assumption that people should feel lucky to be
there.
Yeah,
100%.
And so basically got to a stage where she had to quit. And so she did, she went back to freelancing, started Mother Pucker, and it started to grow. But one of the things that we talked about quite a lot was flexible work and encouraging people to do that. And it's, you know, we're not political lobbyists or anything. It's just the idea was very simple. Make a lot of noise about it. Encourage people to ask for flex and encourage employers to try it. And so actually we started to sort of build momentum, and people, quite a lot of people that followed us weren't aware that after 26 weeks you have the right to ask for flexible working.
No right to get it.
No right to get it. And something like only 4 in 10 women get it, and only 1 in 10 guys get it when they ask.
1 in 10?
1 in 10. And more than once we've heard people get back in touch with us and say, my husband asked and said, look, can he, because he needs to pick up the kids, and his boss said to him, well, what's your wife doing? So there's still quite an old-fashioned attitude in quite a lot of places. But we basically found that actually hundreds, potentially more than that now, through DMs, people have said, well, actually, I asked and I got it and it's made a massive difference. Or I asked, I didn't get it, but now I'm going to come back with a new plan and so on. So part of it was just making people aware of the right to ask. And part of it was going in and doing talks and panels with companies and saying, companies that were interested in offering more flexible working, and saying this is why it's a good thing, here's the business case for it, etc. etc. And alongside that, we've just started to work with a little bit of a coalition of organizations. So that includes the TUC,
Unite.
No. Sorry, that's not been announced yet. Actually, so maybe we can lose that.
Yes, fine, so they're not
announcing till September. So we started working with a coalition of organisations to try and lobby for a law change. I mean, that's something that can take years and years, but it's a process that's worth starting. There's a private members bill that was brought recently that asked for all jobs by default to be advertised as flexible. Now, that's unlikely to make it into law because everything's sort of clogged up with Brexit and so on, but it's there on the books, and there's a bit of momentum building for it. And the most of the main parties have. So that 10-minute bill was brought by a Tory MP, but Labour have announced that towards the beginning of this year that they would like to make flexible working a right from day one and so on. Most of the main parties support the idea to varying degrees. TUC and CBI have both said, you know, flexible working is a good thing, but we're just still, there's such a weird mentality about the fact that you can only do your job if you're at a certain piece of laminated MDF under a certain bit of horrible strip lighting at certain hours.
Yeah. There's so much research that shows that you are more productive and you're more loyal if you get that kind of flexibility at work. I mean, we've had guys, we've spoken about it before on the podcast, and we've had guys contact us to say they've having to move jobs because they can't get the flexibility.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm a big supporter of flexible working. I work a 4-day week, but I try and push shared parental leave in the same way that that you guys are pushing that. And any opportunity for me to talk about it, as regular listeners will know, I will talk about it or give interviews or go on radio or do that kind of thing, because I think you've got to make the awareness of what people are entitled to before they start to ask for it. It's got to become the normal thing that you, when you go into a new job, or it's something that you immediately are, in the same way you ask what's the pension benefits or do I get a gym membership, it's like, what's the flexible working policy?
It's exactly, it's just a sort of slow shift in mentality because the case is there. Like report after report and research after research has shown that actually if companies offer it, then people are more productive, they're more loyal, they're more likely to stay with you, so you don't have all the costs of constantly re-recruiting, they're happier, they're more efficient, there's quite often it brings your costs down because you don't have to spend as much on desk space and all that sort of thing. But there is this kind of knee-jerk, oh well, it wouldn't work, it's too hard, well I need to know where people are. And actually, generally, you don't need to know where people are, you just need to know what they're doing. And flexibility can work. It's easier in an office environment where you're working on some kind of digital document, and that's about 70% of jobs in the UK. But it also works in retail. It can work on factory lines. It can work even in the police and the NHS. There's a massive recruitment crisis in the NHS, and they're realising slowly that one of the ways that they can address that is offering a little bit more flexibility to how people work.
Do you think that, because we've talked about this before, we had Han from Daddy Life, and they commissioned a big survey around this actually, and we were talking there about the way in which almost inadvertently technology might be helping make this case. I mean, do you think, because to me, it, you coming at it, I don't have nearly as much information as you do behind it, but from a kind of outside view, you would assume that the way technology is moving forward, that it's only sort of, it's a sort of an inevitability, it's a kind of a matter of time before we get to be more flexible. Do you think that's
yes
fair?
I think that's absolutely true. And like I mentioned, those sort of 70% of jobs that are office-based, where basically what you're producing is some kind of digital document, whether that's a Word document going to someone or it's a spreadsheet or whatever it is, most of that can be done kind of from anywhere. And there might be a fixed deadline, you know, it needs to be finished by X time on X day. But how you get to that point actually can be a lot more flexible than people realise. And we've got, so the analogy that we make quite often is that we have all of this free range technology, but actually we still have a bit of a battery farm mentality that you have to be here.
Yeah.
Whereas actually, you know, if you are allowed to wander a field and do your work, then you produce nicer eggs.
Yes.
nice.
And that's something that I think people are quite slow to realize. There are some companies that are doing good things and are quite quick to catch on, but there is a bit of a knee-jerk, particularly among the people. You quite often find that, you know, there might be CEOs who say nice things about it, or HR directors. You might find that people in the rank and file want it, but actually there's a bit of a blocker quite often in the middle management.
That's what I was going to say.
Who basically feel that they've got too much on anyway, and it will just make their life harder. Yeah. And their knee-jerk reaction is no.
There is a big discrepancy, sorry Steve, but there is a big discrepancy, isn't there, between big organisations and at the top end of those organisations and how they wish to be perceived. And they can say all the right things.
Yes.
But the actual day-to-day reality, it's not those, it's not, you know, the big brand managers who are making these calls. It's like you said, yes. the middle managers.
Yes.
So how do you how do you fix that discrepancy?
You get middle managers who have done flexible working.
Yes.
You get the next generation of middle management in the same way you get the next generation of dads who have had a more hands-on role with parenting, means that their kids are going to, it's a slower, slower process.
So quite often what we find is that within an organisation, there will be one team that's working completely flexibly and is much more productive and much happier, and there's one that isn't, because individual managers have kind of taken it on themselves to do it. So this is something that's quite common in the NHS, we've found. From trust to trust, there will be someone who's running a team who said, actually, we can, you know, we're not frontline, we're doing all of the admin bits and so on, which is most of the staff in the NHS. We can be a bit more flexible, and their team, the turnover is lower and they're more productive and so on. But then there's another team, a trust down the road, that doesn't have that, and people are a bit more hacked off. There's a remarkable statistic that we got from Flex NHS, which is that on wards where staff are allowed to work more flexibly, fewer people die. Because the frontline medical staff aren't as exhausted, they're not as stressed, they're able to think more clearly and more productively. I mean, that in itself is probably powerful, the strongest case for it. But it's also something that we've found within very traditional corporate environments, in things like finance. So I've forgotten the guy's name, unfortunately, but there was someone who we've spoken to quite a bit who worked at Coutts Bank. And he allowed his team to, I think he had a few female staff members who were pregnant at the same time and obviously and wanted to keep them. And he basically allowed his entire team to work flexibly. Now, this wasn't policy. No one else did it. It was kind of viewed as a little bit out there. But he was able to report back in 6 months and say, okay, so productivity's gone up here. We're making X amount more money there. And prove to people that this change had had a good bottom line impact.
Because I think if you, my experience here, certainly, be careful how I phrase it. My experience is when people are turned down for flexible working, they become more disaffected. Oh, and it's a spiral of, they're not, well, okay, fine. If you won't give me that flexibility, I'm going to clock in exactly on the state. The moment I start clocking exactly, I'm going to take my 15-minute you know, screen breaks. I'm going to take my lunch breaks. And you know, and actually, if you wanted me to do some extra hours, I'm afraid I can't.
Yeah.
You know?
It's a trust issue, isn't it? It's a trust and faith issue. And that's what it comes down to. Because essentially, what if somebody rejects, if I ask for flexible working and I was told no, that to me, what I'm hearing as an employee is, well, you don't trust me. You don't. You think I'm going to be sitting on my ass watching TV at home, which of course I wouldn't be. I'd be doing my job.
Yes.
And I think that's got to be a huge part of this, right? Is that this is it, you're going to have some companies who believe in their employees and say, okay, I trust you to get on with it.
And actually, what you guys do is very easy to measure, right? Mm. You know, people, you have a certain amount of copy to do. You have a certain amount of stories to do or what have you. And people can see that and they can see the quality of that one way or the other. And actually, whether you're in the office or somewhere else, kind of doesn't matter quite a lot of the time. And that's quite true of quite a lot of workplaces, I think.
I think there's sometimes a mentality that if to get on, you need to put in super crazy hours. And unfortunately, if the people making those decisions on flexible working are the people that do those incredibly crazy hours, it's very hard for them to, just sort of like devil's advocate, for them to go, okay, well, you can work flexible, when they haven't got, they're not in that position to do it themselves.
And actually, you know, flexible working doesn't need to be a dramatic thing where you sort of are allowed to completely go where you want, when you want. No. It can be as simple as having core hours. Okay, the office hours are 10 to 4 and you're still expected to do an 8-hour day, but you can be a bit flexible when it starts and finishes. It could be just starting a little bit later. It could be compressed hours.
That's what I do. It start could early, be finish early.
Yeah, job shares, for example. Yeah. All of those things can potentially work. And the main issue is exactly what you were saying, the flexibility, the expectation of flexibility is all one way. And, you know, we all work many, many more hours than we're contracted for in the UK. And, you know, it's quite rare to take an hour for lunch. It's quite rare to leave bang on 5:30, that sort of thing. Flexible working doesn't mean that you necessarily work shorter hours. You know, you might be in an industry where 70 hours a week is the norm. And if that's the case and that's what you have to do to get on, then so be it. But if 10 or 20 of those hours are done at home or are done in a slightly different way, then why not? And the problem is, the flexibility quite often is all one way. People expect you to work more. So, for example, 0 hours contracts are probably a prime example of the wrong kind of flexibility, where all of the expectation is from the employer. We expect you to work only for us. We expect you to work as we need you to. We're not going to give you a holiday. We're not going to give you pension.
What do Amazon call their drivers? Amazon Flex. That's what Amazon call their drivers who are on this, like, got to deliver all the parcels within a certain time, or if you're late, you don't get you hit your target, you don't get paid.
And that's not flexible working. There's no flexibility there. That's a kind of horrible mangling of the phrase. And actually, in those sort of production line roles and driving roles, I mean, there can still be a little bit of flexibility. You can do things like job share and so on. You can do things like, I think there's this weird idea that everyone will have exactly 40 hours worth of stuff to do each week, when that's not really always the case.
Some people work quicker, some people work slower.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, that's...
Speaking of quicker and slower, I think we've been wittering on for a good 40 minutes now. I think we're I think we're coming to the end of our time, but it's really, really
interesting. You've got work to do, Rich.
The irony is, I'm looking at my watch, I'm like, I've got a meeting to go into, which I can't be flexible about.
No,
unfortunately.
Everyone's got to be in it.
But, you know, it's a really, really interesting point. I think flexibility, I would like to think will...
And just to kind of like bring it back around, the flexibility of working, the knock-on effect of being a parent is only positive. It's only positive. You know, it's a lifestyle improvement for you as a human being. But if you've got young kids and you're able to work flexible, they get the benefit of it.
Exactly. Yeah, you make nicer next generation of people.
Well, there you go.
That's the fundamental, isn't it? That is the fundamental.
Well, that's what this is all about.
The more time you can spend with your kids,
we're trying to make nicer.
That's the end goal. Surely, for any parent, you know, mother or father, the end goal here is to spend as much time as you can with your kids, and how you get there isn't really the point. The point is to make sure you are there, that you get to that end point where
flex
I have
flex is one of those ways.
Flex is one of them. Whatever you can
and
do.
And we've kind of, so we've sort of said, we've got a 12 to 15 year window to make this the norm, because depending on whether or not she goes to university, that's when our eldest daughter is going to be entering the workforce. And we don't want them to have to go through that same coin flip of family or career that a lot of women have to go through now.
Interesting.
And I kind of think that's, the momentum anyway, regardless of what we're doing, is going that direction. It's just if
you'd like to think so. So
if we can get there sooner, so
it's how quickly
better.
We can pedal, isn't it? It's going in that right that direction, but what speed is the question?
And if we've got a parent listening to this podcast who wants to find out more about flexible working, where can they go, Matt?
So there are lots of places. ACAS has some info about your rights. The TUC website has quite a lot. There's also an organisation that we worked with quite a lot called Working Families, who have a free legal helpline. If you Google Working Families, they're it's lots of employment lawyers working for free. So there can sometimes be a queue to sort of get on and that sort of thing, but you will get free direct legal advice about your specific situation. But basically, anyone in a full-time role has the right to request flex after 26 weeks. But the issue is that companies can say no for whatever reason they want. But then there's appeal processes and so on.
Okay.
Working Families is a good one because you get to speak to a lawyer directly. TUC and ACAS have lots of
great
info online.
When's the book out?
The next book is Feb 2020, Where's My Happy Ending?
Great. And there is a podcast, I believe, as well.
We have a podcast called
we see it occasionally pop up on the kids and family show.
We have Dirty Mother Pucker, which is basically two panels. So Anna and two of her mates do the first half, then me and two of my mates, and we will discuss a different issue. Whether that's, and they've been relatively
there's an eclectic mix.
There's an eclectic mix, yeah. So there's one that's on called Splashdown, which is about the birth. There's one
brilliant.
There's one on contraception, there's one on in-laws, there's one on, you know, how to make your kids behave. There is almost no useful practical information whatsoever. But hopefully
good note,
it makes people laugh.
So when you finish when you finish listening to First Time Dad and you've reviewed and rated, head over to Dirty Mother Pucker for a bit of light relief.
Exactly. And vice versa.
Yeah.
Matt, thanks for coming in.
Yeah, no worries. Thank you very
really
much.
Interesting.
And good luck with the flex appeal. Yes.